Hi, my name is Martin Purnell, and welcome to Off-Grid Christianity, a weekly podcast for those who go or don't go to church and where we can meet and hear from those that have made their faith count. The podcast series is to encourage via conversation and not necessarily change your mind prior to listening. You can contact us as well by email, ogc@accessradio.biz. So please enjoy today's guest, who first joined us on Off-Grid Christianity in August 2022. See episode 4. Our guest was heavily involved within the US Christian contemporary music scene, and for 10 years he was a creative director at Capitol Records. Our guest is also an author, including a book that was such a big encouragement to me, Jesus, Bread and Chocolate. His latest book, and very good it is indeed, has just been released, The Ballad of the Lost Dogs of East Nashville. But why crowdfund this novel? How do you crowdfund? Why has he given up all the other hats he has been wearing when episode 4 was recorded, to become Director of Music Industry Studies at Lipscomb University? Where is Lipscomb University? If this podcast is anything like our previous recording, will we ever find out? I guess there's so much to share. It gives me great pleasure to welcome back, and if I had a button to push for the crowd to go mad, John J. Thompson.
The crowd is just losing their minds. I love it. It's great. Man, I can't believe it's been 2 years plus.
I know.
How many episodes have you done? If I was on episode 4, what are you up to now?
We celebrated 2 weeks ago the release of our 100th episode.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, we're just past about 100 episodes of the True Tunes podcast too. So,
there you go.
It's crazy when you look back at something like that and see what you've done. That's great.
It is. And we obviously had to listen to it in the car, episode 4, just 2 weeks ago, my wife and I. And it was brilliant. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Oh, good.
Yeah, the interviewer wasn't bad either.
Well, I tell you what, I love your setup, but I don't know that I've gotten rid of too many hats. I just keep a collection here on the desk, and that's why my desk is such a mess. But I tend to kind of keep doing everything. But yeah, I still manage an artist. I still work in the industry. I still, like, you know, work occasionally with films if the right one comes along. I still teach now. I just kind of add stuff, and even the writing thing. This book is something I was working on for 10 years. I was actually coming off of Jesus, Bread and Chocolate. That book wasn't even out yet when I started working on this. And so I always have 5 or 6 things going on at once. So it's never one thing at a time for me. So, and it's all related. In my head, it all makes perfect sense. But so I don't know that it does to anybody else.
Well, it's so nice, John, for me to meet a Christian who can multitask.
Yeah, maybe. I think my mom told me once, she said, I have turned ADD into an art form and a spiritual gift. So I hope it stays that way.
Yeah. No doubt we've got so much to hear from you as well. But before we do,
okay,
5 new questions for you, please, because you've obviously been here before. So let's go for it. Question 1. I'm looking forward to this one as well. Beethoven is teletransported you home and he wants to hear what music is like in 2023. What gig or concert would John take him to?
Ooh, boy, Beethoven. I would probably want to take him to see one of these kind of, I call them like the muso artists, you know, the artists that really get into the musicianship side of things and the compositional side. They're not some of the most popular commercially, but their fans are really devoted. Like Corey Wong just played in Nashville. They're Snarky Puppy, you know, these groups that just really do amazing music. And I think that they dig into the elements of rock and soul and blues and jazz. And I think that would be a good entry point to see what are the best aspects of this music without going straight to the most simplistic kind of dumb side of it, which can also be really fun. But I think he would find that stuff a little bit overwhelming and simplistic. But it would be hard to come away from a Corey Wong show and not be impressed, I would think, or somebody like that.
Well, I haven't got a clue who you're on. So
Corey Henry is another guy. Actually, Corey Henry might even be better. He's an organ player who comes from the gospel world, but then transitioned into playing with, you know, groups like Snarky Puppy. He plays the B3 just an absolute master on the organ, and I would love for Beethoven to see what we've done to the organ. that would be fantastic. That's like and what Henry can do with an organ, and his first solo record is just recorded live. He takes an organ and plays it in a club. So he takes this kind of traditionally sacred music out of the church environment, but brings the church with it. And then people in the Americana rock space, you know, the rock or the organ, the B3, migrated from church music into rock and roll a long, long time ago via blues. And then it's just stayed there. It's definitely stayed there. But what's also interesting is the reason the B3 was ever even in the Black church was because they couldn't afford pipe organs. There's a whole other story to that. Like, there's a functional reason that B3s are in there. And my generation, we came up loving the sound of the B3, associating it with blues and rock artists. And then you hear Corey Henry and the way you hear the way that he plays the B3 and can coax it from these big, soaring, incredible, muscular sounds to these really, really sensitive sounds that almost sounds like it's singing like a little kid in the Vienna Boys Choir.
Yeah.
And that is an exceptional thing I love as well. And then you can hear in that one instrumental, mostly instrumental project, you can hear the history of rock and roll and blues and gospel all in one instrument.
Excuse my ignorance. Who makes the B3?
Hammond. Sorry.
Right. Got you. No, I understand. Oh, when you talk about the Hammond, yes. Immediately, I guess people come to mind on that.
I make these assumptions.
A Hammond organ, yes. Fantastic. Yes, I agree totally what you're saying there. Thank you. Also interesting, because people obviously say that Beethoven is deaf, but my son, when he went to university to study music composition, which he's now got his master's degree in, it was very interesting to hear the senior lecturer say that actually Beethoven, we now know what kind of deafness he had. And actually, had he been born today, they could have operated on him and brought back his hearing. It was something to do with the fact he could hear the bass register.
Oh, well, then he would have loved a B3.
Yeah, I'm sure he would have done, yeah. Question two, then. If you could go back in time and watch any sporting or entertainment event live with a front row seat, what would it be?
It would probably be something like the Monterey Pop Festival in the 60s. Like one of those concerts.
Yeah.
Woodstock seems a little scary to me. Like, I think that would stress me out. But the era when the counterculture music was really still positive and still had all this potential and it hadn't gotten super dark yet, I think that either the Newport Folk Festival or the Monterey Pop Festival, I'd have to do a little research and see who was on which bill.
Yes.
But I might want to really be there the year that Dylan plugged in and went from acoustic to electric and had the band backing him up. That is something I've listened to the concert. I've studied it. I've looked at reactions to people. If people I've heard about what was happening, and there's been different perspectives on it. But to be in the place and experience that and see what are people really, how are they reacting to that kind of tectonic shift? And
yes.
And also all the other music that was going on at that kind of festival. I love festivals. I love the community aspect of festivals. I love the chemistry of festivals. But then when you look backwards, you can see that festival. I mean, I grew up at the Cornerstone Festival and it changed my life. And I worked with the festival then later. And I was proud to be a part of that. And people still tell me how much it changed their lives. So I would probably want to go to one of the festivals that was before my time, you know, so that I could experience that.
Would you like to go to the one in England?
Oh, Greenbelt.
Where he was first caught.
That's one I really always wanted to go to is Greenbelt.
Oh, really?
Oh, my gosh. Yes, I want to go to Greenbelt.
I was actually going to say come over to England and then obviously your telly machine go back and hear the person shout out Judas to Bob Dylan when he plugged in at Manchester Free Trade Hall.
Well, the same kind of thing was happening at you know, the first time he plugged in. Yes. And I've seen that on the Pennebaker film. That I think he has that moment on that
Don't Look Back
or some one of those films. But yes, that kind of thing when people are freaking out saying you're a Judas, you're betraying our movement, and then it's like the same people probably about a year later love everything that he's doing. Like, and art is supposed to be a little bit ahead of us. It's supposed to pull us forward. It's supposed to challenge us. It's not supposed to just be a product we consume like bubble gum or whatever. And especially the reason people loved Bob Dylan was that was the nature of what he was doing and continued to do. So the irony that these kids who loved him because he was a vanguard folk artist, and then when he takes, there's nothing that's not folk about what he's doing on Subterranean, like all of that is still folk music. He's just using an electric guitar. And so I like to be in those kind of semi-dangerous places. But Greenbelt was one that I was invited to play with my band, The Wayside, in the early 90s, but the money was not enough to cover the cost of bringing the whole band over. It was when our first record came out. And I always regretted not going over there. I mean, to me, Greenbelt and Cornerstone were like cousins, and I really wished I had made it over to Greenbelt, because I really valued and appreciated the perspective that Greenbelt had on things. It was a little bit more progressive and inclusive and interesting. And I remember when friends of mine played there and then they would report back, and I always thought, oh man, I want to get to Greenbelt someday. And I never did. Same thing, festivals, you know.
Which instrument did you play in the band?
I was lead singer, played guitar, you know, and as it evolved, it became more of a duo thing with Michelle and I both doing lead vocals. Back then, I was definitely the lead singer, and she was more of a backing vocalist. But yeah, I was kind of the front man for the thing. And then later, we found out we could have hired. Do you know Adrian Thompson?
I do, yeah, indeed.
So Adrian has become a good friend. And back after I didn't go, Rick Elias, who had produced our very first kind of demos, had told me, well, you should just go and then have Adrian's band be your band over there, because he did that for Rick. And we did that for bands in America. Like later on, we backed up Larry Norman and we backed up Randy Stonehill and people here. So my band kind of became the house band for different people. And so he was like, you should do that over there. Just you go over and let his band be The Wayside. And maybe you and Michelle go over. And that idea hadn't occurred to us until it was too late.
There's a band split level, but we could talk about that some other time. Question three. If you could invite any biblical character for an evening meal so that you could then ask him questions, who would it be?
I think I told you Peter last time, and I think I'm going John this time. I have really been very, very interested in John for years. And I even had Steve Scott, fellow Brit, on my podcast a few times talking about John. You know, he's obsessed with love. John writes like a writer. I mean, he writes like an artist. His gospels, his epistles, he's not just saying this is what happened and then this is what happened. And he's writing like an artist. And it's kind of psychedelic at times. But it's also this idea when he refers to himself as just the disciple whom Jesus loved. I really would love to just spend time thinking like, what is going on there? And love is such a theme throughout all of his work. And it's so, love to him is so radical. It's so transformational that it kind of consumes his own identity. He stops even thinking of himself as a person with a name, and he just becomes the person Jesus loved. And that is something I would love. I don't know what the afterlife looks like, but I hope that can get unpacked, because as time has gone on, I'm thinking, man, there's just kind of love and then there's everything else. And he was kind of zeroing in on that. And I find that really interesting, especially the way the world has been unraveling lately. It seems like we're kind of offered two paths, and John's path is the one I'm trying my best to stick to. You know, so it's I would love to get past, like sometimes with artists, the reason I like to hang out with them sometimes, and sometimes you don't, is because the art that they're creating is compelling and it's enveloping and it's challenging and it's stimulating. But then sometimes it's great to say, now, when you say this, this is how I'm getting it. This is how I'm interpreting it. But where was your head when you were coming up with this? Like, and I don't buy the idea that, you know, when John sits down to write, the Holy Spirit picks up his hand and just moves, like he's just sort of a, you know, a passive player. I think that God works through our gifts and our creativity. And so I would love to have that. Now, some artists can't, it's very unsatisfying when you have those conversations with them, because they're like, I don't know what I was thinking. It doesn't mean anything to me. And then you're kind of like, oh, that's a bummer. I thought this was going to be interesting, but I have a feeling it would be an interesting conversation with him.
Very much so. Well, the next question then, what would you cook for John?
I'd have to think about dietary things and find out where he was on that stuff. I'd probably try to do something healthy. I would find out what he was interested in and try to be a good host, you know.
Fish, I would think.
I would think, yeah. I was thinking something kind of fish tacos or something.
fish tacos with some lamb on the side or something, yeah, a doner kebab.
Right.
Final question then. What do you remember most about your wedding day and why?
Golly, you know, what's funny about weddings is I've said this before. I was married 33 years ago, and it's like, it's almost like a movie you watched a long time ago. Like there's so many things going on. You're out of your body or something. Like everything is so, and I was very, very young, and there was a lot of, it feels like a lot of pressure, and you put a lot into it, and then you're just not really present. One fun memory that's related to music too, you'll get a kick out of, is that I had managed to pull a surprise off, which was that during the rehearsal and everything else, we had said that a friend of ours was going to sing. There's a Stephen Curtis Chapman song called I Will Be Here that was this really popular song. Everybody, I think, in that time kind of had to have it at their weddings. But the trick was going to be that actually I was going to sing it to Michelle as she came down the aisle. And so it was a big surprise. And it was in a big church and all this stuff. And I'm a singer. You know, it's, but at that point, I was still younger and my voice was pretty strong and pretty known for, you know, singing strong, loud. I could sing a lot higher, all that stuff. And when she starts coming down the aisle and I'm singing with the microphone, and instead of singing all this like normal kind of big voice stuff, I'm like, I will be here. It was like the most pathetic kind of puny sounding thing ever. The photos you see are just like full of big early 90s hair and then this like puny sounding voice as I tried to sing to her as she's coming down the aisle. And so we pulled off the surprise. She was pretty shocked, but it was definitely sincere and kind of goofy. That was, yeah.
You see, I thought the sting in the tail for the story was going to be that halfway through you gave up and actually on came Stephen Curtis Chapman to sing it.
That potential would have come a few years later, but this was still early in the saga. So.
Yeah. Great answers. Thank you very much indeed. Well, John, I contacted you a few months ago to say, help me out sort of thing. Here's something you might be interested in. And you wrote back and said, well, why don't we do another podcast? Because a lot of things have happened to me. And I thought, well, that'd be great. Let's do a return. So what's happened to you since we last talked to you way back in August 2022?
Yeah, well, I mean, like you kind of alluded to in the intro, I'm now a full-time professor at Lipscomb University. I'm heading up the Music Industry Studies program here. And I had been the associate dean of the School of Music at Tribeca, but that wasn't a full-time teaching thing. It was never even really a full-time job. I was kind of helping the school create events and connect with artists and people that I knew from the music business and do some special programs. But here I'm actually teaching a full load of classes and overseeing internships and doing all the practicums and working with all of the adjunct teachers that do kind of overhauling the whole degree program. It's a lot. And plus I finished my degree in the process because I never even had graduated from college back in the day. So it's been wow, a busy few years. And I finished this novel that I've been working on for about 10 years. And so it's been a really crazy 2 years, probably the busiest 2 years of my life. The COVID time was, I was very busy during that whole kind of, while everybody else was sort of resting, I was doing a lot of running in the park and working. I was writing, I was producing the podcast, and I was still doing things, you know, events online and stuff like that. But then when things started to lighten up, and Brown Bannister, who is one of the architects of Christian music, he kind of discovered Amy Grant and developed her whole career and produced tons. I mean, 50 years of, we've lost count of how many Grammys and Dove Awards that guy's won. But I met Brown years ago when I was doing Grammy work in the screening committees for the Grammys, and we always stayed in touch. And we were in late 22, I guess. We were catching up because I was helping there's a venue in Nashville that had reopened. It was the Koinonia Coffee House. It was kind of ground zero for the Jesus music scene in Nashville back in the 70s. It was connected to Belmont Church, and it's where Honey Tree and it's where Amy Grant played her very first concert when she was 14.
Oh.
So back in the day, that was, and Brown was one of the youth pastors at that church. That's where they connected. And I was tapped by the Well is a nonprofit coffee shop, or kind of series. They got five locations. They use high-end coffee to raise money to dig wells and provide clean water in the developing world in the coffee belt area.
Ah.
And I've known them and appreciated their work for years. So they asked me to come on board and help them with that location kind of figure out how to find sponsors and create special events and that kind of stuff. So for about a year, I was just sort of doing that as a consultant, helping, you know, connect them with some different things. And in the process, did some fun kind of Jesus music reunion events there, and also connected with a group of musicians there that they call it the Live on Music Row band, where we play every other month. That's not really a Jesus music thing. They specifically do mainstream stuff. But in the process of that, reconnected with Brown, and Brown reached out about seeing if I might be interested in getting back into academia, which at the time I was not. But he can be very convincing. So he had a class that he was teaching, and he asked if I would be interested in just coming on as an adjunct and co-teaching it with him for one semester, just to kind of check out the culture here at Lipscomb. And another good friend of mine, Steve Taylor, who I'm sure you're familiar with, Christian music.
The Steve Taylor?
Yeah. So Steve is a professor here as well in the film department. And so Steve reached out and encouraged me to think about it. And then Don Chaffer, who was in a band called Waterdeep, or still is in a band called Waterdeep, he's been a good friend for a long time. He reached out and was like, hey, you should really. So they kind of put the full court pressure on to get me to think about it. And I was like, I got a lot of good friends over there. Mike Naraki, he's the head of the animation department. Mike was Larry the Cucumber from the VeggieTales world. And
oh, was he?
Yeah. And so these are all people I really trust. And I thought, man, this many people are in this university. There's got to be something going on there. Charlie Peacock, who's one of my longtime musical heroes and mentors, had been the first director of the commercial music program here at Lipscomb. And then due to health issues, had stepped aside. And he had tapped Brown to come in and kind of take his place. After talking to all of these people, I thought, well, at least I could do is go do this one semester and see if this is the right fit. And in the process of doing that semester, they decided that they definitely would like to have me come on full time. And as I think it was sort of like an audition on both sides, like they were checking me out and I was checking them out. And so basically I came on full time and took on this job. And at the time I thought, well, I can do that and still do everything else. And this is definitely an all-encompassing gig. Like it's hard to do everything else. So it took me a little bit longer to get the book finished. And the reason I decided to not just self-publish, but to start a publishing company, because there's a need, I think, for publishers do different things now than they used to do. And this is a different kind of story, but it's not the only one like it. I think there's other authors and other stories that need to find an audience that is for stuff that is spiritual, that is inspirational, that is soulful, but is not specifically limited to just a Christian market. And it's also multimedia. It's books are now not just words on paper. Books can feel kind of like podcasts. They can feel they're audiobooks, but audiobooks, formal audiobooks, are actually a relatively small part of the market, but podcasts are growing. Mm. How can they be kind of turned into a hybrid thing? And what are some different financial models that can make them affordable and also support authors? And how do you connect books for, you know, what about artists who are musicians who want to write memoirs or short stories and this kind of thing? So we're going to try to really develop that stuff out over the coming years.
That sounds absolutely brilliant. And for people saying, Charlie Peacock, I've heard of him, an amazing producer, obviously an artist in his own right. When I joined contemporary Christian music scene way back in the mid-1990s, first track I remember of his was called Bannerman, I think.
Bannerman was Steve Taylor.
Oh, Steve Taylor. Whoops.
Yeah. And that was in the 90s, yeah.
Yeah, Steve Taylor was Bannerman. Shows you how much time I've been away from this. Yeah, so anyway, Charlie Peacock, great man because he produced a lot of stuff. He brought through a load of artists as well as a good musician. And of course, Steve Taylor, the first time I heard of him was when he did Bannerman, which is a great track. Sort of an ironic look at a person or persons at sporting events who would run past with John 3:16 yes. on there.
Yeah, thinking that they're saving the world by sneaking the Bible verse into the Super Bowl or something. Yeah, yeah, right.
I wonder if that actually worked.
Yeah, I don't know. But you got to admire their heart, I guess. They're trying. They're doing something that they think is productive, at least.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, I'm talking in the mid-80s, I was not interested in what you would call CCM. Contemporary Christian music to me as a genre often felt like it was music made for Christians. It was not music made by Christians for the whole world. That was always what was exciting to me. To me, music that was marketed and manufactured and intended strictly for Christians always felt like a bit of a put on. it tended to have to go through certain hoops and things that made it less interesting creatively, because the Christian market couldn't tolerate ambiguity and it couldn't tolerate risk, and they couldn't cover certain topics and things that I thought were important to cover. So the art side of it suffered. But when Christians made art with their Christianity latent, as Tolkien and Lewis would have said, it made for some of the best art. That's where you get your Bob Dylans and your Van Morrisons and your Bonos and your all that stuff. And even if it's not Christianity, but it's adjacent to your Leonard Cohen's, you know, Alice Cooper, you know, it's like there's all kinds of stuff that you can go, oh, there's all of this. And so Steve Taylor and Charlie Peacock were both people that were Christians making music that I always felt belonged on the table for everybody to consider. And they both had moments where it was in different ways. Charlie Peacock, as an artist, was originally, you know, from the Sacramento Exit Records scene, and they had distribution into the mainstream market. And he had moments where, you know, he had a shot, but then later would have a huge impact on the mainstream as a producer, working with groups like Switchfoot at first, and then lots of CCM artists. But then, you know, Civil War is getting Grammy Awards because of working with Charlie Peacock, or at least, you know, after having worked with Charlie Peacock. And Steve Taylor, you know, even if as an artist, you know, his mainstream shot was with the band Chagall Guevara, and they're fantastic and made a practically perfect album, didn't really do anything. Got great reviews, but it just was, you know, wasn't their time. But then later, when he produced Sixpence None the Richer's, their breakthrough album, and forced them to put the song Kiss Me that they wrote, that becomes the biggest song in the world, you know? And so Steve does have a massive, massive impact, you know, with another younger group that he helped to develop. And it's that same kind of thinking of like, some of us are going to have the impact with our own direct work, and sometimes it's going to be secondhand through the artists and people that we support and develop. Either way, it's still creativity. It's still generative, you know, all that kind of stuff. And they were those two guys, I've said this since I was in my early 20s, Steve Taylor, Charlie Peacock, and Glenn Kaiser from Rez Band were three of the most important influences on me. So the fact that I'm sitting here in this office, you know, that's directly related to, you know, the program Charlie Peacock helped start, and I'm working alongside Steve Taylor every day is not lost on me. That's pretty, pretty cool.
Because they often say in mainstream media that you should never sort of go meet your heroes and things like that.
That's if you choose bad heroes, right? Right.
That is true, I suppose, isn't it? But yes, you're doing it. And I want to crank up a gear now, if that's all right, please, John, because a lot has happened to me, as everyone else could say, post-COVID, especially in our last 2 years since we last hooked up. What have you learned, first of all, in the past 2 years regarding your faith in what you've been doing?
Oh, boy. You know, I think that the journey or the process, it goes back more than 2 years. I don't think there's anything unique in the last 2 years other than maybe a crystallizing of certain things. I will say that I'm dismayed at the confirmation of some things that I've believed and said about the difference between institutional religion and politicized religion and gospel living. These are things that I have been discipled in and passionate about for a long time. They go all the way back to, you know, the mid-90s when I was in my mid-20s. And I was challenged by people, you know, people at Cornerstone Festival for a lot of it, authors that I was reading, John Perkins. I remember a time being in one of the speaker trailers at Cornerstone Festival, and it was John Perkins and I, maybe one other person. And I was still kind of clinging to a little defensiveness, and a little bit of it was based on being young and being a little ignorant. And I had some ideas about politics that were just not fully baked. And he was saying a few things that were challenging some of my political assumptions about something. But his generous, soft, sweet demeanor invited a conversation where the two of us, and I think there was a third person, sitting on couches or chairs in this trailer backstage. I mean, say backstage, it's kind of where the speakers could gather and grab a cup of coffee or something at Cornerstone, planted seeds. He didn't confront or humiliate me or anything, but he challenged some of my things, which is questions that were about defensiveness and about, you know, the rendering unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is God's. And that if we are needing to compromise on the clear commands of Jesus in order to accomplish what we think God is calling us to do, then what we think God is calling us to do is not the gospel. So we're never going to have to compromise those things, like caring for the poor, like loving our neighbor, like speaking the truth. And so then I go back to John and love what love is, and then Paul amplifying that in 1 Corinthians. And so I can see this through line where I was not ready for it. And it wasn't a transformational one time. The light came on and now I see everything. It was a gradual process. And I had to gradually become humble and teachable. And then I had to also tune out the voices in my life that were toxic, that were replacing grace and love and peace and all of the fruit of the Spirit with vitriol and self and anger and all that stuff. And when I did, I started to see the importance of community and teachability and humility and service and smallness and all that stuff. And in the process of doing all of that, it was a gradual leaning towards small things, small group, small church, intimacy, and away from corporate things, large things. And when we got into the COVID time, it was like the world forced us to all go small for a while. Like it removed the capacity for large groups. And what was interesting was to see how some people just could not handle it. They got so freaked out because their whole identity was wrapped up in scale. And then they politicized everything. So everything became a political issue. Their church, the ability to gather for church in person, was now not a health issue. It was a political issue. It wasn't a spiritual thing. Our church at the time was a house church. We had 8 people getting together. So it was actually relatively simple for us to do that safely or to do it online for a while.
Yes.
But when people had so surrendered their identity and their spirituality and their spiritual formation to this big scale, then there was just no other way for them to redeem that. They just became super threatened by turning that dial down. And it was interesting that Jesus Bread and Chocolate came out right in 2015, late 2015, early 2016. And so I did all these events, speaking events in all kinds of different environments. And there was still mostly benefiting from the kind of trends of craft made this and that and the sort of hip nature of that. But then during COVID times, it seemed a little bit more like the people I was talking to were kind of desperate for, it was like a lifeline to them. The book still never really broke through. It never became super popular. It was still very much an underground thing. But the people I heard from that did read it felt like it was a lifeline to them. And for us, we found a tiny little church in our neighborhood. We found this little Anglican church that we were able to connect with that's, 20, 25 people on a Sunday. And it feels like a house church and it's connected to the tradition I grew up in. And the pastor is focused on, he's a good expositor, he's a good teacher. The liturgy anchors everything together, but it's all about discernment and thinking. And it's small enough that we can all relate to each other. And now I'm seeing what's going on here, I'm sure there, but the confluence of power and fear-based thinking and faith, like there's just this massive miss going on. And I'm sure I'm still missing aspects of it, but I think that it's so heartbreaking to see how many people that are just swallowing this bait and tolerating hatred and lies, and they're craving it like they're craving water, but what they're getting is filth, and it's just devastating. And I know we all heard it was coming, we all thought about it, but it was all rhetorical, and now it's here. And I was just thinking the other day how I think music and art that I've been consuming for 30 years, because I was digging for the deep stuff and I was really processing it, maybe that's kind of helped prepare me for this. But we're sitting on the cusp of just, I don't know, it feels like the gospel is definitely back to being a minority, which I think it probably always was. The difference between true gospel thinking and living versus Christendom, which is this sort of sanctified version of, you put a cross on the building and call it a Christian building, or you put a cross on the tank and call it a Christian tank and then use it to destroy your enemies. It's like, that's not the gospel. That's Constantinianism or something, but it's not Christianity. So I think we're heading into this era where we're about to see what real gospel living is. And it's very countercultural and it's very, very small.
So bearing that in mind, then, if we are heading into the next phase, which is going to be countercultural, what can you and I do about it? What can people listening do about it to move it on?
Well, one thing I feel is that we need to disabuse ourselves sometimes about trying to always think about what can we do to move the culture. And I mean, I'm a culture person. So there's sometimes when it's like, oh, let's start a movement or let's do something, let's bring classic rock back or whatever. That's different. But when it comes to the church, when it comes to the gospel, I'm thinking about where the word says, you know, love your neighbor and care for the, you know, feed the hungry and visit the orphan, visit the those in prison and take care of the orphans and the widows. Because against these things, there is no law. Like when you live that kind of radical love, there's no law against that. And when we think, okay, well, instead of taking everything up to the biggest level and trying to think about scaling our quote-unquote faith or our culture wars up and having the biggest impact we can, what if you were to do the opposite and say, what's the closest impact I can have? How can I have a deep and profound impact on the person or the people that are closest to me? My next door neighbors, the people in my office, my family. And if instead of taking this corporate idea that we have to have a strong brand and we have to market it well and we have to distribute it well and we have to give the people what they want and all that crap, if we could instead say, who are the people right at my feet? Who is it? My kids? Is it my neighbors? Is it my students? Is it my coworkers? Who is it? And how can I love them well? Like, what is it that they need? Do they need food? Do they need clothes? Do they need an ear? Do they need my time? What is it that I can do? How can the love of God come through me to those people? And sometimes it's going to be a very quiet kind of presence. It's a ministry of presence. But sometimes it is, in my experience, there are times when you've earned the right that someone comes to you and asks you really hard questions. Like, there's this thing in my life that really is messing me up. Is this what sin is? And it's like, oh boy. Oh, now this is like, this is when the theology and the discernment and the spirit really comes in. But you have to earn the right to do that. You have to love, they have to know that you love them so much that when they come to you and say, I keep hitting my knee with this hammer and I don't know why my knee hurts. Do you think it's the hammer? Mm. But you've earned the right that they come to you and ask you that. And you say, well, maybe it's the hammer, or maybe it's you and the hitting motion. Because if we just take the hammer away, you'll find something else to hit your knee with. And they go, oh boy, I didn't think of that. So maybe it's not the hammer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Maybe it's my fist. What is my hand connected to? It's connected to my heart. Oh, so what is sin? And then we can talk about brokenness and we can talk about all of this stuff, but you have to earn that. If instead you just go to everybody with a hammer and start talking about sin, they don't have any idea what you're talking about. You're not relevant to them. You haven't earned the right to go there with them.
Yeah.
And so we're taking on this marketing approach, this corporate approach, and we have brands and we have affiliations and we have passions. And what we do is we end up gathering the masses that agree with us, turning them into teams and making money and gathering power and assuring ourselves that we're right because we have these numbers, and we're not getting anywhere. We're not doing anything valuable. But if instead we earn the right to speak the truth in love to the people who have said, boy, this is hard. Why is my knee hurt so bad? And they say, oh man, I'm glad you asked. What's going on? And that to me is what we can do. But I think that's what we're called to do. I don't think Jesus ever called us. What does he say? When he says, go into all the world, what does he say to do once we're in all the world? Make disciples. Like, he doesn't say go into all the world and like build massive systems and brands. And you don't make disciples 1 to 20,000 or 1 to 5,000 or 1 to 500. You make disciples one at a time or one to few. I can make a couple of disciples at a time. Jesus could do it with 12, and he was Jesus. He's probably got some special talent for this. I don't know if I can do it to 12. I might be limited to doing it to 4 or 5, and I'm pretty good at it. And then, you know, once those disciples are formed and they're off doing it, they can do it to a few. And that model changed the world. But when we start doing it as a factory model, all we're doing is brand building. And it's just, it's proven to be deadly. It's just destroyed our witness in the world. And now the people who are called by his name that are trying to be love, like John calls himself the disciple Jesus loved, people that are feeling compelled, they're afraid to even call themselves Christians because of what's being done in Christ's name.
Yeah, exactly. I'd like to talk later on about the book. I know we've only got a limited amount of time. Whilst we're staying on here and the fact that in a few days' time, next week, in fact, you have a certain election.
Oh, yeah.
I don't want to know who you're voting for, but if I could have a way whereby I could phone up Kamala and I could phone up Donald and say, listen, just do me a favor, have a listen to John, invite him along and have a one-to-one with him. And of course, because it's me, they say, yes, certainly, Mark, we'll do that. No problems at all. I know, for instance, Tony Campolo had a monthly meeting with the previous presidents.
Yeah.
If we could offer that to you as well, John, what would you say to them? Individually, obviously.
Boy, that's hard to even imagine. Tony Campolo had a big impact on me as well, both personally and from afar. But
yeah.
I would say, if you don't understand that you still have stuff to learn as a leader, and that the highest calling for any leader is to be a servant, then you're not qualified to lead. I usually would start by asking questions, because the best way to lead, I think, is to ask questions and to be curious. And I think that you can do the math on that one. But when I say, you know, who are some of the best leaders, the most effective leaders, you can learn a lot about the heart of a person by the answers they give to a question like that.
Yeah.
And like when George W. Bush said that his favorite philosopher was Jesus, I was like, huh? Why philosopher? What about his philosophy? I would have liked to have talked that through with him. What did he mean by that? Was it because of him being in alcohol recovery? Like, maybe he did think of Jesus as a philosopher that way. But when people talk about Jesus as a leadership figure, that's an open door to start saying, oh, great, let's talk about that. How did Jesus demonstrate leadership? Now, you're going to be limited by whatever their actual awareness of Jesus is and how much exposure they have to the gospel, to the word, to church history. But I would go back to each of them and say, let's just go back to say, well, before he left, when he knew that he was going to be crucified, which is the ultimate example of servant leadership, I would say, what did he say and do? You know, he could have gone on a tirade. He could have talked about blaming his enemies. He could have planted all kinds of conspiracy theories. He could have run away. It would have been easy for him to escape. He walked right into it. But what did he tell how did he plant this movement that would go on without him?
Yeah.
How did he lead? Well, first, he washed their feet. So let's talk about what that means. You know, like, let's think about washing their feet. Let's think about, what did he do? How did he even treat Judas when he knew exactly what Judas was doing? So if I had an opportunity to talk to a significant leader, I would start by saying, well, I think Jesus and the movement he started, it's hard to argue with, was a pretty effective movement. And he is a pretty effective leader. So let's look at the leadership, the servant leadership model of Jesus, and say, what does that really look like? And let them do the math in their heart and their mind about whatever gap might exist between them and that. Because, the spirit convicts, and people's hearts are either open or they're not, but you can't convict people. That's, I guess, what I would try to do is to start with that and say, let's think about what servant leadership really looks like, and let's look at Jesus's example. And then the fact that all of the remaining disciples ended up walking out something very, very similar to that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's such a pity that you're not president, because that makes so much sense. You're up there with President Josiah Bartlett, and if people are saying, who's he? Go and watch The West Wing.
Right. I don't think I would make a very good president.
Oh, I don't know. We could have a laugh, couldn't we?
Yeah, right.
Not at you.
I've long had a theory that a good person can't be elected president. Kamala might, this path is so short for her that this could challenge that. But my theory is, you have to sell your soul so many times to get there that there's nothing left. That our best hope is a bad person or a compromised person, the process of getting there, or once they get there, they have some sort of transformational experience when they're there. But the problem is, once you get that much power, if you really do encounter this kind of relationship, this experience with Jesus, the first thing you start to do is get rid of power, because the Holy Spirit's going to very quickly open your eyes to the toxicity of that kind of power, and you're going to start investing that power in other people.
Let's move away from politics. I focus on your book. You very kindly sent me a PDF, so I'm well away through it now, and it is fantastic.
Thank you.
How much of it is autobiographical?
Well, it's interesting. And I mean, it's not autobiographical in any kind of classic sense. It is based in my neighborhood. So it is definitely, you'll get a feel for where I live when you read this.
Yeah.
And all of the characters are mashups of people I've known. So when you get a taste for these people, you'll be getting a taste of fictional people that are made up, most of them of two or three or four people that I've heard their stories. Some of them are very, very close to me. Some of them are people I encountered, and I just thought, what a fascinating story, and I pulled that and turned them into characters. So Stephen King and other authors have said that whenever you write fiction, every character in some regards is an extension of the author, and I didn't read that or hear that until after I was done with my first draft of this. And I thought, that's weird. I don't think that's true. And then I'm just now listening back to my audiobook for the first time all the way through. Like, you do it and then you edit it and you hear it in pieces, but I'm now listening all the way through it. I'm even getting emotional at times listening to this thing and going, man, I really like this. And I don't think it's autobiographical, but I do think it is aspirational. There are elements of each of these characters that reflect what I would like to be. And then there are probably elements of their failures that are autobiographical. So if you come across something, you're like, oh, this guy sounds cool. That's probably how I would like to be. If there's things about like where they screw up or where their foibles are, that's probably me. But one of the funniest stories I've got is when my 98-year-old grandma read it. She was getting into it, and there's one particular account where Cesar, who's the Hispanic character, meets with his priest, Father Mac, and they go to get a beer because the priest was recognizing that Cesar was going through something and wanted to have some time with him. And after their exchange, my grandma said she got so excited by this part of the book that she was like, oh, I want to meet this priest. John will know this priest. I bet you he could get me on the phone with him. She'd forgotten for a little bit that this was fiction. And so she was like going to call me and say, hey, do you think I could get on the phone with this priest? She was resonating with Cesar's concerns for his family. And she was thinking this priest could be a good person to talk to. And then it was like for a few minutes, she was thinking John could connect me with this guy. And then she was like, wait a second, this guy doesn't exist. John is this guy. So there was kind of fun to think I'd tricked my grandma for a few minutes. So.
It's interesting as well, because way back in my previous career as a training officer, I was trained to say, basically, if you're going to tell a story about yourself, always make it something that went wrong in your job or whatever, because people can learn from that. Otherwise, if you keep talking about how everything was brilliant and, oh, look, I was able to sell £2 million worth in one day.
Those are not interesting stories.
Always talk about the bad things that you can learn from. Well, in that case, then, what have you learned from it, from having written the novel about yourself?
After it was done and I looked back, I was like, what kind of book is this? I've come up with this description of it being a rock and soul fable, because I came up with, like, what is a fable? A fable, you know, is just a story, but it tells you something about, it's got some sort of a point to it. To me, this story imagines, I think it does reflect some longing, some true longing that I know exists in our community, and I'm sure in communities everywhere, and the reconciliation and connection and those types of things fairly universally. But the scenario and the plot and what actually happens is a bit fantastical. And so I realized when it was all said and done, and I was describing it to somebody one night, that it kind of reveals what I wish I could see happen. And so in that regards, it reveals one aspect of kind of the longing of my heart.
Yeah.
But then in that conversation, this person was like, well, it does seem like this is the kind of stuff you've been working towards your whole life. I hadn't thought of that either, that that's true. Like, if you want to think about what I'm doing now at Lipscomb, working with students, there's that in here. You can see that in here. If you want to think about what I did for years at Cornerstone, you can see that. So it really is kind of almost like an impressionistic piece of art where you can kind of capture, but it does reflect the longing that I've always had, where music is the excuse for people to come together. But it's really the excuse. It's the catalyst. What we really need is something deep. We need healing. We need catharsis. We need reconciliation, connection. And music is how that happens. When we get together to experience music and none of that stuff happens, it's just a waste. So yeah, that's the thing there.
The thing is, referring back to Jesus Bread and Chocolate, which I'm showing you, the cover, which is stupid, really, because this is an audio program. But, you know, you got it published on one of the major, if not the biggest, publishing house. Why go self-publishing stroke, should we say, crowdfunding for this book?
Well, the crowdfunding piece was really just to get the ball rolling. The plan is I'm launching my own publishing program. And the idea was I had an agent that represented this. The first step, I actually did a very small crowdfunding thing just to a handful of people to raise enough money to hire an editor a few years ago. Because I realized that back in the old days, to get a book out, you had to print massive quantities and ship them to tons of stores all over the world. You don't do that anymore. That's not a thing. Now, most of it is digital and it goes through one store, Amazon. And Amazon, because of that, you have no competition. So the margins are terrible. The economic model is terrible because it's a monopoly. But the opportunity means, well, because there's no bookstores or there's very few bookstores left, you don't really have the cost of printing a ton of books and shipping a ton of books. So what publishers really do now are two things. On the front end, they find the authors in the books and they do the development side. So they sign the authors, they work with editors, they develop the books. They take the book concepts from good to great by working with editors on the content side. And that's what I did in that first phase by hiring an editor who's a world-class editor. She works with major publishers. And I basically paid her the same amount that a publisher would have paid her to work with me for over a year to take what was my finished manuscript and make it even better. So that happened. The second thing that they do is distribution and marketing. And I learned that from the Jesus Bread and Chocolate book. Zondervan, HarperCollins, they marketed it for 1 month. They hired a few people. And then I did the rest of it after that. I did a bunch of podcast interviews. I went on tour and did 60 dates. I did two tours in Ireland. I did stuff all over the US. I realized that that phase is something I'm actually pretty well aware of. And when it was all said and done, I was like, well, maybe, you know, if a mainstream publisher saw this book and said, okay, we could take the marketing to a bigger level because we really see the potential here, then fine. And I had an agent that worked with me for 2 years. He was convinced that a mainstream publisher would want it. And so he pitched it and they all loved it. And they said, this is ready to go. We love this book. Let's do this. But they felt like it was so spiritual. It had such a spiritual angle to it. And now all of the mainstream publishers own all of the Christian publishers, including Zondervan. And so they wanted to send it to their Christian divisions. And I just thought, oh no, I know how this is going to go. So they did. Now, after they had all said they loved it, they sent it to their Christian divisions. The Christian divisions all really liked it, but felt like, well, it's not really a Christian book, which I had never said that it was. I mean, I think that it is in the way I understand it to be, but I know that the Christian books, kind of like Christian music, are more, that means that it's books for Christians. This is a book for everybody. In the same way that I felt like Steve Taylor and Charlie Peacock's music was music by Christians for everybody, this is a book by a Christian for everybody. They said if you could just change one of the characters and have them have a transformation where they don't believe and then they do by the end, if you could take a little bit of the language out, if you could just make a few tweaks, then it would be perfect for the Christian market. And I said, no, I don't want it to be perfect for the Christian market. I want it to be authentic and true for the whole world. Like, that's my goal. So people that are fans of The Commitments and That Thing You Do and Sister Act and, you know, Almost Famous, those types of people, I want to love this story. That was the response of the Christian publishers. And it goes back to the mainstream publishers. They're confused because to them, they're like, oh, we thought it was so spiritual. And if our Christian divisions are thinking this, then maybe we don't know how to market this. So my agent and I, we were thinking, well, if really we've already done the work of editing, and I've been a writer for so long and I've been an editor on other people's books, he's like, you should just start your own imprint and do the marketing work and find the audience that doesn't care about content being pre-screened and safe for the whole family and all that stuff. Find that audience, sell this directly, And then not only can I put other books out to those people, but I can work with other authors. And we can also create alternate content. We can take books and turn them into audio experiences and build new models for how to distribute stuff. So that's the idea. So the crowdfunding thing was just to get the money that I needed in order to build a website, build the distribution platform for this first thing. And so we were successful in that, and it'll come out in December. I've got the first batch of books being printed right now. The website's just pretty much done. I've got, in fact, I can show you, I just got these yesterday. This is a mug, Nashville Biscuit House on this side. And then it's got the, which is a big part of the story, and then Los Perros of East Nashville on this side. So this is one of the premium things we did for the Kickstarter. And when I do book events, I'll be able to sell things like mugs and t-shirts and things like that, just like what bands do. Oh, also I have this. This is the bookmark.
Oh, yes.
So this, we'll have these bookmarks. So this is a ticket, like a ticket stub from one of the events that takes place in the story. Made these. So it's, you know, it's what publishers do. I'm just doing that stuff. And then I've got another book in development already that's about servant leadership in the music industry. And I've got a rework of my book Raised by Wolves from 25 years ago that'll hopefully be coming out. And then I'm looking at doing short stories as well and hoping to work with other authors. Once I get this pathway built and this distribution thing built and the marketing thing built, then hopefully we'll be able to do more like that.
Well, we've rapidly run out of time, unfortunately. That's how brilliant you've been to us always, being able to share stuff. As I said, we'll see if we get the answer to where the university is. We never got that really. So that doesn't matter. That proves my point.
It's in Nashville.
No, I do. John, if the listener would like to find out more about this book, obviously this isn't going to be going out until December, January time, by which time you have launched most of the things you've been talking about. How can they find out more?
Yeah, well, you can always find out anything about me at truetunes.com. But then this book has a new website that we're launching that's lostperros.com. So lostperros.com. You can see that site now. There's an audiobook. There's an ebook. The print books will come out in December. And then there's packages where you can get it with t-shirts and mugs and all that kind of stuff as well. But then truetunes.com is still where the podcast is and my blog, and you'll be able to find all that stuff. And so joining the email list is really important, and following me on Instagram and all that stuff at TheOnlyJJT, all of that is really important as well.
Well, can I just say, for those that have been intrigued by what you've shared, just go and have a look at the cover of the new book, The Ballad of the Lost Dogs of East Nashville, because if you don't want to order a t-shirt as a result of seeing the cover, well, I know nothing.
Craig Yingst did the artwork, and he did just a fantastic job. He's a national treasure.
It's wonderful. John, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for all your help and your patience yet again with technology so we could get this recorded. Really appreciate that. And I look forward to seeing you episode 200.
All right. Thanks, Martin.
That'd be great. Thanks, John.
All right. Bye-bye.
God bless. Bye-bye. Next time on Off-Grid Christianity.
So since then, the network has grown, but we meet on Zoom. So we do get some people joining us from, say, New Zealand and some other countries. That's when we started that network, to connect people, to help them be the best they can be in business. But after a while, after a couple of years, we found that we got the social side of that well, of connecting people together, but there was a bit of a frustration. And when we looked at it, we wanted to see not just the social side of it, but we wanted to see Christians having an impact on the business world, in their workplaces, and the culture that was happening around them. So we changed the title from Crosslink to Crosslink Transformation Network. We put the T in there for a specific purpose, and we started bit by bit to change from just learning about business and helping each other in business to actually really being a Christian in business, and how God wants us to partner with him in the workplace. Because to me, the workplace is the lost mission field, is the missing mission field.
So please join me next time with our special guest here on Off-Grid Christianity, Frank Bennett. Until then, cheerio.